and welcome back to the Eternal Now, that is the Cory Doctorow podcast under conditions of pandemic, where you and I are locked in our homes in a moment that stretches forever with so little differentiation apart from moments of stark terror and unintentional comedy. I didn't know what day it was today. I'm recording this on Sunday, the 26th of April. And somehow I got it into my mind this week that it was Mother's Day today. I think maybe it's a bit of confusion because we celebrate Mothering Sunday for my mother-in-law in the UK and then Mother's Day for my wife and my mom in Canada. And anyway, I just got very confused. So we planned a whole surprise Mother's Day this morning. Our daughter made a beautiful Mother's Day card and I wrote a very heartfelt inscription. I made my wife breakfast in bed and a cup of coffee. We brought it to her. We sang her a song. And then my daughter came into the room a few minutes later and said, "You know, it's not Mother's Day." It's not Mother's Day, but the time is eternal. And we get to have another Mother's Day in a couple of weeks because why not? What are you doing with your eternal time? Well, we've got a Dungeons & Dragons game planned for this afternoon. My goddaughter, Ada Norton, is going to DM a game for some friends over Zoom. She's doing a one-shot, rolling up characters for us. It's going to be super fun. I am also growing an ill-advised lockdown beard. Imagine me, but with Scotch Brights taped to my face that itch with the ferocity of 1,000 termites. That's the reality I'm living right now, and I'm sticking to it. I'm kind of shooting for the full Allen Ginsberg, because I'm also not cutting my hair, and I've worn it very short since I was about 18. So my flat top is growing out and out and out and out and out. How about you? How's your sartorial splendor? So let me tell you what's going on in my life apart from that. I just finished Joe Walton's next book. It's a tremendous book. Comes out in July, called Or What You Will. It's this metafiction about a dying author, and it's told from the point of view of one of her characters who has a plan to keep her alive forever so the character can live forever. And it's set mostly in contemporary and a fictional Renaissance Florence, heavily influenced by Ada Palmer, as is so much of the best work of Joe Walton. It's a really good book, Or What You Will. It's out in July. The next thing I'm going to do after I record this is write her a blurb and then write a review to publish when the book comes out. On April 29th, that is this week, it is not Mother's Day. It is the day that I will appear at the Reset Everything conference, which is at resetEverything.events. And it's my talk on the lessons of the pandemic for tech policy. I continue to write and thoroughly enjoy writing Pluralistic, my post-Boing Boing daily link blog. It has no tracking and it has no data collection and it generates no analytics or statistics, which is great because it kind of liberates me from the tyranny of trying to figure out what other people might like. But on the other hand, it is a bit of a shout into the void. Some of you have been kind enough to write and let me know what you think. If you want to leave a comment there or send me an email about the stuff you like, I'd be very happy to hear it. I don't want to get moment-to-moment, real-time analytics feedback, but I wouldn't mind hearing from people and having a bit of a dialogue with them. As ever, I have three books coming out in 2020, and God only knows whether I'll have a tour or whether there will be bookstores or whether there will be publishers or whether money will still be a thing or whether anyone will be literate or whether we will be digging through rubble looking for canned goods and drinking our own urine. But assuming that some of those things don't happen, then on July the 7th, you can pick up the omnibus edition of Little Brother and Homeland with a new introduction by Edward Snowden. And on July the 14th, you can pick up my first ever picture book, Posey the Monster Slayer, illustrated by the brilliant Matt Rockefeller, a book about a little girl who would rather hunt monsters with field-expedient monster-killing weapons she makes out of the toys in her bedroom than go to sleep, and the frustration of her parents with this situation. It's a bedtime story for monster kids and for kids who should be monster kids. And then finally, the third Little Brother book, Attack Surface, is coming out on October the 12th. And there is a big announcement coming about that on Tuesday about some cool opportunities for people who pre-order it. I hope you will tune into my feeds or you can hear about it on next week's podcast. So this week's podcast, as previously promised, this week's podcast is the first hour-ish of a new reading I'm going to serialize of my 2009 novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. This is a very weird novel. It is a science fiction novel that is also a piece of urban fantasy, very much in the model of things like the Borderlands books and Ariel, Stephen Boyd's books, books that were hugely influential on me as a kid. Also Charles DeLint and other kind of forerunners of the contemporary urban fantasy model. It has a weird backstory too. My parents came to visit me once when I was living in San Francisco, and we went out to wine country, to like Mendocino or somewhere, and got an Airbnb. Not an Airbnb, we got an actual B&B. This was long before Airbnb. We got a B&B room, a pair of B&B rooms. I had some trouble sleeping, as I do sometimes, and I just banged out the first 2,000 words of this incredibly weird story about a guy whose father is a mountain and whose mother is a washing machine, who moves to Toronto, to the Kensington Market, bohemian neighborhood, and gets involved in building mesh wireless networks with a local dumpster diver who pulls electronics out of the suburban electronics warehouses for them to rehab into mesh wireless boxes. It's a very weird premise, and it didn't go anywhere. I wrote those 2,000 words. I abandoned the book for like 3 years. And then I got stuck on another book. It's actually the only book I ever started as an adult that I never finished, a book called User Bin God that I wrote about 80,000 words of before giving up on. And I got stuck on this book and started adding to Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town as a way to kind of get away from it and rethink about it. And I wrote a page a day until the book was done. And as I was nearing the ending, I realized that the ending that I thought I'd been writing towards was not going to work, and kind of got sad and walked around and moped, and then thought of a much better ending and wrote that ending, was very satisfied. It was a weird moment to finish the book. I finished the book while I was at Esther Dyson's old conference in the desert, the PC Forum, which was this amazing, intense tech conference. And Neal Stephenson had done a keynote, and we'd all stayed up late having a couple of drinks. And then I went back to my room, and I only had, you know, 4 or 5 pages to go. And I wrote those 4 or 5 pages, and I was so tired. And I actually nodded off after writing the last sentence and continued to write in my sleep, and wrote 2 or 3 sentences afterwards, and kind of shook myself awake and was like, ugh! And then deleted those 2 or 3 sentences. And then I got an email from my old friend, Liz DeBoer. Liz, if you're listening now, hi, saying, hey, I was just thinking about you. I'm up really early in Toronto. Must've been 5 a.m. there. And I had a brief conversation with her in which I recounted this fact that I had, through automatic writing, finished this novel. Anyway, and then, like, you know, I got back to Toronto. I'd been working in Toronto on this book. It was in the period between when I lived in San Francisco and when I moved to London. I had a couple of weeks in Toronto while I kind of got things together, cleared out my old apartment and so on. And so I got back to Toronto and I turned the manuscript over and went back to page one thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to like rewrite this whole book because I just wrote a completely different ending to the one that I'd been writing towards for all these years. And when I turned the book over and read those like first paragraphs that I'd written in the middle of the night in that hotel room in Mendocino when I was in wine country with my parents, there was the foreshadowing of the ending that I had just written. So I had known that that was going to be the ending for 5 or 6 years, but had not known it explicitly until I wrote it. So that is the weird story of how I came to write Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. It is a weird book. I would love to write a book like this someday again. I've been kind of looking around off and on for a subject that would lend itself to this treatment. It's not my next book. The next book I'm writing, as I mentioned many times here, is The Lost Cause, my post-Green New Deal Truth and Reconciliation novel. And cool beans, I actually finished the prologue of that book, the first 8,000 words or so, this week. And speaking of Joe Walton and Or What You Will, Joe has got this project called the New Decameron Project that is this open access but Patreon-supported storytelling project for the lockdown, and she's going to publish it this week. So you can actually read the prologue of The Lost Cause this week. Anyway, I recorded the first hour of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town as my contribution to this weekend's Potapalooza Festival, which was a charitable benefit for Give Directly, which makes direct cash transfers to families who are adversely affected by coronavirus. And it aired this weekend on the festival. I did a live Q&A with it on Saturday. And as promised, now it's here in my podcast feed, and I will be picking this up and adding to the serialization of it week on week until the book is done. I'll probably take some breaks when I have new essays come out, new locus columns, and kind of break in and read those. But any week that I don't have a new essay or a new short story out, this is what I'm going to read. So anyway, I hope you enjoy this first hour or so, and I hope you'll hang in there for the rest of this, the weirdest novel I ever wrote. And here we go. Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Someone comes to town, someone leaves town, by Cory Doctorow. Dedication. For the family I was born to and the family I chose, I got lucky both times. Alan sanded the house on Wales Avenue. It took 6 months, and the whole time, it was the smell of the sawdust, ancient and sweet, and the reek of chemical stripper and the damp smell of rusting steel wool. Alan took possession of the house on January 1 and paid for it in full by means of an e-gold transfer. He had to do a fair bit of handholding with the realtor to get her set up and running on e-gold, but he loved to do that sort of thing, loved to sit at the elbow of a novitiate and guide her through the clicks and taps and forms. He loved to break off for impromptu lectures on the underlying principles of the transactions, and so he treated the poor realtor lady to a dozen addresses on the nature of international currency markets, the value of precious metals as a kind of financial lingua franca to which any currency could be converted, and the poetry of vault shelves and 100 banks around the world piled with the heaviest of metals, glinting dully in the fluorescent tube lighting, tended by gnomish bankers who spoke 100 languages but communicated with one another by means of this universal tongue of weights and measures and purity. The clerks who tended Alan's many stores, the used clothing store on the beaches, the used bookshop in the annex, the collectible tin toy store in Yorkville, the antique shop on Queen Street, had both benefited from and had their patience tried by Alan's discursive nature. Alan pretended never to notice the surreptitious rolling of the eyes and twirling fingers aimed temple-wise among his employees when he got himself warmed up to a good oration, but in truth, little ever escaped his attention. His customers loved his little talks, loved the way he could wax rhapsodic about the tortured prose in a Victorian potboiler, the nearly erotic curve of a beat-up old table leg, the voluminous cuffs of an embroidered silk smoking jacket. The clerks who listened to Alan's lectures went on to open their own stores all about town, and by and large, they did very well. He'd put the word out when he bought the house on Wales Avenue to all his protégés. Wooden bookcases! His cell phone rang every day, bringing news of another wooden bookcase found at this flea market, that thrift store, this rummage sale, or estate auction. He had a man he used part-time, Tony, who ran a small man with van service, and when the phone rang, he'd send Tony over to his protege's shop with his big panel van to pick up the case and deliver it to the seller of the house on Wales Avenue, which was ramified by cold storages, root cellars, disused coal chutes, and storm cellars. By the time Alan had finished with his sanding, every nook and cranny of the cellar was packed with wooden bookcases of every size and description and repair. Alan worked through the long Toronto winter at his sanding. The house had been gutted by the previous owners, who'd had big plans for the building, but had been tempted away by a job in Boston. They'd had to sell fast, and no amount of realtor magic, flowers on the dining room table, soup simmering on the stove, could charm away the essential dagginess of the gutted house, the exposed timbers with sagging wires and conduit, the runnels gouged in the floor by careless draggers of furniture. Alan got it for a song and was delighted by his fortune. He was drunk on the wood, of course, and would have paid much more had the realtor noticed this, but Alan had spent his whole life drunk on trivial things from others' lives that no one else noticed, and he developed the alcoholic's knack of disguising his intoxication. Alan went to work as soon as the realtor staggered off, reeling with a New Year's Day hangover. He pulled his pickup truck onto the frozen lawn, unlocked the kryptonite bike lock he used to secure the camper bed, and dragged out his big belt sander and his many boxes of sandpaper of all grains and sizes, his heat strippers and his jugs of caustic chemical peeler. He still had his jumbled, messy place across town in a nondescript two-bedroom on the Danforth, would keep on paying the rent there until his big sanding project was done and the house on Wales Avenue was fit for habitation. Alan's sanding project. First, finish gutting the house. Get rid of the substandard wiring, the ancient lead-leaching plumbing, the cracked tile and water-warped crumbling plaster. He filled a half-dozen dumpsters, working with Tony and Tony's homie Nat, who was happy to help out in exchange for cash on the barrelhead, provided that he wasn't required to report to work on two consecutive days, since he'd need one day to recover from the heroic drinking he'd do immediately after Alan laid cash across his palm. Once the house was gutted to brick and timber and delirious wood, the plumbers and the electricians came in and laid down their straight shining ducts and pipes and conduit. Alan tarped the floors and brought in the heavy sandblaster and stripped the age and soot and gunge off of the brickwork throughout until it glowed red as a golem's ass. Alan's father, the Mountain, had many golems that called him home. They lived round the other side of his father and left Alan and his brothers alone because even a golem had the sense not to piss off a mountain, especially one it lives in. Then Alan tackled the timbers, reaching over his head with palm sanders and sandpaper of ever finer grains until the timbers were as smooth as Adirondack chairs, his chest and arms and shoulders athrob with the agony of 2 weeks' work. Then it was the floorwork, but not the floors themselves, which he was saving for the last on the grounds that they were the low-hanging fruit. That materialized a new lecture in his mind, one about the proper role of low-hanging fruit, a favorite topic of MBAs who'd patronize his stores and his person, giving him unsolicited advice on the care and feeding of his shops based on the kind of useless book learning and jargon slinging that Fortune 100 companies apparently paid big bucks for. When an MBA said low-hanging fruit, he meant easy pickings, something that could and should be snatched with minimal effort. But real low-hanging fruit ripens last and should therefore be picked as late as possible. Further, picking the low-hanging fruit first meant that you'd have to carry your bushel basket higher and higher as the day wore on, which was plainly stupid. Low-hanging fruit was meant to be picked last. It was one of the ways that he understood people, and one of the kinds of people that he'd come to understand. That was the game, after all, understanding people. So the floors would come last, after the molding, after the stairs, after the railings and the paneling. The railings, in particular, were horrible bastards to get clean, covered in 10 or 30 coats of enamel of varying colors and toxicity. Alan spent days working with a wire brush and pointed twists of steel wool and oozing, stinging paint stripper until the grain was as spotless and unmarked as the day it came off the lathe. Then he did the floors, using the big rotary sander first. It had been years since he'd last swung a sander around. It had been when he'd opened the tin toy shop in Yorkville, and he'd rented one while he was prepping the place. The technique came back to him quickly enough, and he fell into a steady rhythm that soon had all the floors cool and dry and soft with naked, exposed, woody heart meat. He swept the place out and locked up and returned home. The next day, he stopped at the Portuguese contractor supply on Ossington that he liked. They opened at 5 a.m., and the men behind the counter were always happy to sketch out alternative solutions to his amateur construction problems. They never mocked him for his incompetence, and they always threw in a 10% contractor's discount for him that made him swell up with irrational pride that confused him. Why should the son of a mountain need affirmation from runty Portuguese with pencil stubs behind their ears and scarred fingers? He picked up a pair of foam rubber knee pads and a 10-kilo box of lint-free shop rags and another carton of disposable paper masks. He drove to the house on Wales Avenue, parked on the lawn, which was now starting to thaw and show deep, muddy ruts from his tires. He spent the next 12 hours crawling around on his knees, lugging a tool bucket filled with sandpaper and steel wool and putty and wood crayons and shop rags. He ran his fingertips over every inch of floor and molding and paneling, feeling the talc softness of the sifted sawdust, feeling for rough spots and gouges, smoothing them out with his tools. He tried puttying over the gouges in the flooring that he'd seen the day he took possession, but the putty seemed like a lie to him, less honest than the gouged out boards were, and so he scooped the putty out and sanded the grooves until they were as smooth as the wood around them. Next came the beeswax, sweet and shiny. It almost broke his heart to apply it, because the soft, newly exposed wood was so deliciously tender and sensuous. But he knew that wood left to its own would eventually chip and splinter and yellow, so he rubbed wax until his elbows ached, massaged the wax into the wood, buffed it with shop rags so the house shone. 20 coats of urethane took 40 days, a day to coat and a day to dry. More buffing, and the house took on a high shine, a slippery slickness. He nearly broke his neck on the slippery staircase treads, and the Portuguese helped him out with a bag of clear grit made from ground walnut shells. He used a foam brush to put one more coat of urethane on each tread of the stairs, then sprinkled granulated walnut shells on it while it was sticky. He committed a rare error in judgment and did the stairs from bottom up and trapped himself on the third floor with its attic ceilings and dormer windows, and he felt like a goddamned idiot as he curled up to sleep on the cold, hard, slippery, smooth floor while he waited for his stairs to dry. The urethane must be getting to his head. The bookcases came out of the cellar, one by one. Alan wrestled them onto the front porch with Tony's help and sanded them clean, then turned them over to Tony for urethane and dooring. The doors were UV-filtering glass, hinged at the top and surrounded by felt on their inside lips, so they closed softly. Each one had a small brass prop rod on the left side that could brace it open. Tony had been responsible for measuring each bookcase after he retrieved it from Alan's protege's shops and sending the measurements off to the glazier in Mississauga. The glazier was technically retired, but he'd built every display case that had ever sat inside of any of Alan's shops and was happy to make use of the small workshop that his daughter and son-in-law had installed in his garage when they retired him to the burbs. The bookcases went into the house, along each wall, according to a system of numbers marked on their back. Alan had used Tony's measurements and some CAD software to come up with a permutation of stacking and shouldering cases that had them completely covering every wall, except for the wall by the mantelpiece in the front parlor, the wall over the countertop in the kitchen, and the wall beside the staircases, to the ceiling. He and Tony didn't speak much. Tony was thinking about whatever people who drive moving vans think about, and Alan was thinking about the story he was building the house to write in. May smelled great in Kensington Market. The fossilized dog shit had melted and washed away in the April rains, and the smells were all springy ones, loam and blossoms and spilled Tetra Pak fruit punch left behind by the pan-ethnic street hockey league that formed up spontaneously in front of his house. When the winds blew from the east, he smelt the fish stalls on Spadina, salty and redolent of Chinese barbecue spices. When it blew from the north, he smelled baking bread in the kosher bakeries, and sometimes a rare whiff of roasting garlic from the pizzas and the steaming ovens at Massimo's, all the way up on College. The western winds smelled of hospital incinerator, acrid and smoky. His father, the mountain, had attuned Art to smells, since they were the leading indicators of his moods. Sulfurous belches from deep in the caverns when he was displeased, the cold non-smell of spring water when he was thoughtful, the new-mown hay smell from his slopes when he was happy. Understanding smells was something you did when the mountain was your father. Once the bookcases were seated and screwed into the walls, out came the books, thousands of them, tens of thousands of them. Little kids' books with loose signatures, ancient first edition hardcovers, outsized novelty art books, mass market paperbacks, reference books as thick as cinder blocks. They were mostly used when he'd gotten them, and that was what he loved most about them. They smelled like other people, and their pages contained hints of their lives. Marginalia and pawn tickets, bus transfers gone yellow with age, and smears of long-ago meals. When he read them, he was in three places. His living room, the author's heads, in the worlds of their previous owners. They came off his shelves at home, from the 10x10 storage down on the lakeshore. They came from friends and enemies who'd borrowed his books over the years and who'd forgotten to return them. But Alan never forgot. He kept every book in a great and deep relational database that had begun as a humble flat file, but which had been imported into successive generations of industrial-grade database software. This, in turn, was but a pocket of the database, the inventory, in which Alan had input the value, the cost, the salient features, the unique identifiers, and the photographic record of everything he owned, from the socks in his sock drawer to the pots in his cupboard. Maintaining the inventory was serious business, no less important now than it had been when he'd begun it in the course of securing insurance for his bookshop. Alan was an insurance man's worst nightmare, a customer from hell who'd messenger over five banker's boxes of detailed cross-referenced inventory at the slightest provocation. The books filled the shelves, row on row, behind the dustproof, lightproof glass doors. The books began in the foyer and wrapped around the living room, covered the wall behind the dining room and the kitchen, filled the den and the master bedroom and the master bath, climbed the short walls to the dormer ceilings on the third floor. They were organized by idiosyncratic subject categories and alphabetical by author within those categories. Alan's father was a mountain, and his mother was a washing machine. He kept a roof over their heads, and she kept their clothes clean. His brothers were a dead man, a trio of nesting dolls, a fortune teller, and an island. He had only two or three family portraits, but he treasured them, even if outsiders who saw them often mistook them for landscapes. There was one where his family stood on his father's slopes, Mom out in the open for a rare exception, a long tail of extension cords snaking away from her to the cave and the diesel generator's three-prong outlet. He hung it over the mantle, using two hooks and a level to make sure that it came out perfectly even. Tony helped Alan install the collectibles cases along the house's two-story stairwell, holding the level while Alan worked the cordless power driver. Alan's glazier had built the cases to Alan's specs, and they stretched from the treads to the ceiling. Alan filled them with made-in-occupied Japan tin toys, felt tourist pennants from Central Florida gator farms, a stone from Marie Laveau's tomb in the San Luis One Cemetery in New Orleans, tarnished brass Zippos, small-frame comic book bodybuilding ads, carved Polynesian coconut monkeys, melamine transistor radios, Bakelite snow globes, all the tchotchkes he'd accumulated over a lifetime of picking and hunting and digging. They were gloriously stuffed and non-mint. He'd always sold off the sterile mint and packaged goods as quickly as he could, squirreling away the ones that were marked with property of Freddy Terrazzo and shaky ballpoint, the ones with tooth marks and frayed boxes taped shut with brands of sticky tape not offered for sale in 50 years. The last thing to go in was the cellar. They knocked out any wall that wasn't load-bearing, smeared concrete on every surface, and worked in a loose mosaic of beach glass and beach china, smooth and white with spidery blue illustrations pale as a dream. Three coats of urethane made the surfaces gleam. Then it was just a matter of stringing out the cables for the clip-on halogens, whose beams he took care to scatter off the ceilings, to keep the glare to a minimum. He moved in his horsehair sofa and armchairs, his big old bed, his pots and pans and sideboard with its novelty decanters, and his entertainment totem. A man from Bell Canada came out and terminated the data line in his basement, in a room that he'd outfitted with an uninterruptible power supply, a false floor, dry fire extinguishers, and a pipe break sensor. He installed and configured the router, set up his modest rack and home servers, fished three four-pair wires through to the living room, the den, and the attic, where he attached them to unobtrusive wireless access points, and thence to weatherproofed omnidirectional antennae made from copper tubing and PVC that he'd affixed to the building's exterior on short masts, aimed out over Kensington Market, blanketing a whole block with free internet access. He had an idea that the story he was going to write would require some perambulatory cogitation, and he wanted to be able to take his laptop anywhere in the market and sit down and write and hop online and check out little factoids with a search engine so he wouldn't get hung up on stupid details. The house on Wales Avenue was done. He'd repainted the exterior a lovely robin's egg blue, fixed the front step, and planted a low-maintenance combination of outsized rocks from the Canadian Shield and wild grasses on the front lawn. On July 1st, Alan celebrated Canada Day by crawling out of the attic window onto the roof and watching the fireworks and listening to the collective sighs of the people densely packed around him in the market. Then he went back into the house and walked from room to room, looking for something out of place, some spot still rough and unsanded, and found none. The books and the collections lined the walls, the fans whirred softly in the ceilings, the filters beneath the open windows hummed as they sucked the pollen and particulate out of the rooms. Alan's retail experience had convinced him long ago of the selling power of fresh air and street sounds, so he refused to keep the windows closed, despite the fantastic volume of city dust that blew in. The house was perfect. The ergonomic marvel of a chair that UPS had dropped off the previous day was tucked under the wooden sideboard he'd set up as a desk in the second floor den. His brand new computer sat centered on the desk, a top-of-the-line laptop with a wireless card and a screen big enough to qualify as a home theater in some circles. Tomorrow, he'd start the story. Alan rang the next door house's doorbell at 8 a.m. He had a bag of coffees from the Greek diner. 5 coffees, one for each bicycle, locked to the wooden railing on the sagging porch, plus one for him. He waited 5 minutes, then rang the bell again, holding it down, listening for footsteps over the muffled jangling of the buzzer. It took 2 minutes more, he estimated, but he didn't mind. It was a beautiful summer day, soft and moist and green, and he could already smell the fish market over the mellow brown vapors of the strong coffee. A young woman in long johns and a baggy tartan t-shirt opened the door. She was excitingly plump, round and a little jiggly, the kind of woman Alan had always gone for. Of course, she was all of 22, and so was certainly not an appropriate romantic interest for him. But she was fun to look at as she ungummed her eyes and worked the sleep out of her voice. "Yes," she said through the lock screen door. Her voice brooked no nonsense, which Alan also liked. He'd hire her in a second, if he were still running a shop. He liked to hire sharp kids like her, get to know them, try to winkle out their motives and emotions through observation. "Good morning," Alan said. "I'm Alan, and I just moved in next door. I brought coffee." He hefted his sack in her direction. "Good morning, Alan," she said. "Thanks and all, but..." "Oh, no need to thank me. Just being neighborly. I brought 5, one for each of you and one for me." "Well, that's awfully nice of you." "Nothing at all. Nice morning, huh? I saw a robin just over there on that tree in the park not an hour ago. Fantastic." "Great." She unlatched the screen door and opened it, reaching for the sack. Alan stepped into the foyer and handed it to her. "There's cream and sugar in there," he said. "Lots. Don't know how you folks take it. So I just figured better sure than miserable, better to err on the side of caution. Wow, look at this. Your place has a completely different layout from mine. I think they were built at the same time. I mean, they look a lot alike. I don't really know much about architecture, but they really do seem the same, don't they, from the outside? But look at this. In my place, I've got a long corridor before you get to the living room, but your place is all open. I wonder if it was built that way or if someone did that later. Do you know?" "No," she said, hefting the sack. "Well, I'll just have a seat while you get your roommates up, all right? Then we can all have a nice cup of coffee and a chat and get to know each other." She dithered for a moment, then stepped back toward the kitchen and the stairwell. Alan nodded and took a little tour of the living room. There was a very nice media totem, endless shelves of DVDs and videos, including a good selection of Chinese Kung Fu VCDs and black and white comedies. There was a stack of guitar magazines on the battered coffee table, and a cozy sofa with an Afghan folded neatly on one arm. Good kids. He could tell that just by looking at their possessions. Not very security conscious, though. She should have either kicked him out or dragged him around the house while she got her roomies out of bed. He thought about slipping some VCDs into his pocket and returning them later, just to make the point, but decided it would be getting off on the wrong foot. She returned a moment later, wearing a fuzzy yellow robe whose belt and seams were gray with grime and wear. "They're coming down," she said. "Terrific," Alan said and planted himself on the sofa. "How about that coffee, hey?" She shook her head, smiled a little, and retrieved a coffee for him. "Cream? Sugar?" "Nope," Alan said. "The Greek makes it just the way I like it. Black and strong and aromatic. Try some before you add anything. It's really fantastic. One of the best things about the neighborhood, if you ask me." Another young woman, rail thin, with a shaved head, baggy jeans, and a tight t-shirt that he could count her ribs through, shuffled into the living room. Alan got to his feet and extended his hand. "Hi there, I'm Adam, your new neighbor. I brought coffees." She shook his hand, her long fingernails sharp on his palm. "Natalie," she said. The other young woman passed a coffee to him. "He brought coffees," she said. "Try it before you add anything to it." She turned to Alan. "I thought you said your name was Alan." "Alan, Adam, Andy, doesn't matter. I answer to any of them. My mom had a hard time keeping our names straight." "Funny," Natalie said, sipping at her coffee. 2 sugars, 3 creams, she said, holding her hand out. The other woman silently passed them to her. "I haven't gotten your name yet," Alan said. "Right," the other one said. "You sure haven't." A young man, all of 17, with straggly sideburns and a shock of pink hair sticking straight up in the air, shuffled into the room, wearing cutoffs and an unbuttoned guayabera. "Adam," Natalie said. "This is Link, my kid brother. Link, this is Artur. He brought coffees." "Hey, thanks, Artur," Link said. He accepted his coffee and stood by his sister, sipping reverently. "So that leaves one more," Alan said, "and then we can get started." Link snorted. "Not likely. Krishna doesn't get out of bed before noon." "Krishna?" Alan said. "My boyfriend," the nameless woman said. "He was up late." "More coffee for the rest of us, I suppose," Alan said. "Let's all sit and get to know one another, shall we?" They sat. Alan slurped down the rest of his coffee, then gestured at the sack. The nameless woman passed it to him, and he got the last one and set to drinking. "I'm Andreas, your new next-door neighbor. I just finished renovating, and I moved in last night. I'm really looking forward to spending time in the neighborhood. I work from home, so I'll be around a bunch. Feel free to drop by if you need to borrow a cup of sugar or anything." "That's so nice of you," Natalie said. "I'm sure we'll get along fine." "Thanks, Natalie. Are you a student?" "Yup," she said. She fished in the voluminous pockets of her jeans, tugging them lower on her knobby hips, and came up with a pack of cigarettes. She offered one to her brother, who took it, and one to Alan, who declined, and then lit up. "Studying fashion design at OCAD. I'm in my last year, so it's all practicum from now on." "Fashion? How interesting," Alan said. "I used to run a little vintage clothes shop in the beaches, called Tropical." "Oh, I love that shop," she said. "You had the best stuff. I used to sneak out there on the streetcar after school." "Yep, he didn't remember her exactly, but her type? Sure. Solo girls with hardcover sketchbooks and vintage clothes, home-tailored to a nice fit." "Well, I'd be happy to introduce you to some of the people I know. There's a vintage shop that a friend of mine runs in Parkdale. He's always looking for designers to help with repros and rehab." "That would be so cool. Now, Link, what do you study?" Link pulled at his smoke, ashed in the fireplace grate. "Not much. I didn't get into Ryerson for electrical engineering, so I'm spending a year as a bike courier, taking night classes and reapplying to next year." "Well, that'll keep you out of trouble at least," Alan said. He turned to the nameless woman. "So what do you do, Apu?" she said to him before he could say anything. "Oh, I'm retired, Mimi," he said. "Mimi," she said. "Why not? It's as good a name as any." "Our name is," Link started to say, but she cut him off. "Mimi is as good a name as any. I'm unemployed. Krishna's a bartender." "Are you looking for work?" She smirked. "Sure. What you got?" "What can you do?" "I've got 3/4 of a degree in environmental studies, 1 year of kinesiology, and a half-written one-act play. Oh, and student debt until the year 3000. "A play," he said, slapping his thighs. "You should finish it. I'm a writer too, you know." "I thought you had a clothing shop." "I did. And a bookshop, and a collectible shop, and an antique shop. Not all at the same time, you understand. But now I'm writing. Gonna write a story, then I imagine I'll open another shop. But I'm more interested in you, Mimi, and your play. Why have finished?" She shrugged and combed her hair back with her fingers. Her hair was brown and thick and curly, down to her shoulders. Alan adored curly hair. He'd had a clerk at the comic shop with curly hair just like hers, an earnest and bright young thing who drew her own comics in the back room on breaks, using the receiving table as a drawing board. She'd never made much of a go of it as an artist, but she did end up publishing a popular annual anthology of underground comics that had captured the interest of The New Yorker the year before. "I just ran out of inspiration," Mimi said, tugging at her hair. "Well, there you are. Time to get inspired again. Stop by any time and we'll talk about it, all right?" "If I get back to it, you'll be the first to know." "Tremendous," he said. "I just know it'll be fantastic. Now, who plays the guitar?" "Krishna," Link said. "I noodle a bit, but he's really good." "He sure is," Alan said. "He was in fine form last night, about 3 a.m. He chuckled pointedly. There was an awkward silence. Alan slurped down his second coffee. "Whoops," he said. "I believe I need to impose on you for the use of your facilities." "What?" Natalie and Link said simultaneously. "He wants the toilet," Mimi said. "Up the stairs, second door on the right. Jiggle the handle after you finish." The bathroom was crowded with too many towels and too many toothbrushes. The sink was powdered with blusher and marked with lipstick and mascara residue. It made Alan feel at home. He liked young people. Liked their energy, their resentment, and their enthusiasm. Didn't like their guitar playing at 3 a.m., but he'd sort that out soon enough. He washed his hands and carefully rinsed the long curly hairs from the bar before replacing it in its dish, then returned to the living room. "Abel," Mimi said, "sorry if the guitar kept you up last night." "No sweat," Alan said. "It must be hard to find time to practice when you work night." "Exactly," Natalie said. "Exactly right. Krishna always practices when he comes back from work. He blows off some steam so he can get to bed. We all just learn to sleep through it." "Well," Alan said, "to be honest, I'm hoping I won't have to learn to do that. But I think that maybe I have a solution that we can both live with." "What's that?" Mimi said, jutting her chin forward. "It's easy, really. I can put up a resilient channel and a baffle along that wall there. Soundproofing? I'll paint it over white and you won't even notice the difference. Shouldn't take me more than a week. Happy to do it. Thick walls make for good neighbors." "We don't really have any money to pay for renovations," Mimi said. Alan waved his hand. "Who said anything about money? I just want to solve the problem. I'd do it on my side of the wall, but I've just finished renovating." Mimi shook her head. "I don't think the landlord would go for it." "You worry too much," he said. "Give me your landlord's number and I'll sort it out with him, all right?" "All right," Link said. "That's terrific, Albert, really." "All right, Mimi? Natalie?" Natalie nodded enthusiastically, her shaved head whipping up and down in her thin neck precariously. Mimi glared at Natalie and Link. "I'll ask Krishna," she said. "All right then," Alan said. "Let me measure up the wall and I'll start shopping for supplies." He produced a matte black, egg-shaped digital tape measure and started shining pinpoints of laser light on the wall, clicking the egg's buttons when he had the corners tight. The Portuguese clerks at his favorite store had dissolved into hysterics when he proudly shown them the $300 gadget, but they were consistently impressed by the exacting CAD drawings of his projects that he generated with its output. Natalie and Link stared in fascination as he did his thing with more showmanship than was technically necessary, though Mimi made a point of rolling her eyes. "Don't go spending any money yet, cowboy," she said. "I've still got to talk to Krishna, and you've still got to talk with the landlord." He fished in the breast pocket of his jean jacket and found a stub of pencil and a little steno pad, scribbled his cell phone number, and tore off a sheet. He passed the sheet, pad, and pencil to Mimi, who wrote out the landlord's number and passed it back to him. "Okay," Alan said. "There you go. It's been a real pleasure meeting you folks. I know we're going to get along great. I'll call your landlord right away, and you call me once Krishna's up, and I'll see you tomorrow at 10 a.m. to start construction. God willing and the crick don't rise." Link stood up and extended his hand. "Nice to meet you, Albert," he said. "Really. Thanks for the muds, too." Natalie gave him a bony hug, and Mimi gave him a limp handshake, and then he was out in the sunshine, head full of designs and logistics and plans. The sun set at 9 p.m. in a long summertime blaze. Alan sat down on the twig chair on his front porch, pulled up the matching twig table, and set down a wine glass and a bottle of Niagara Chardonnay he brought up from the cellar. He poured out a glass and held it up to the light, admiring the new blister he'd got on his pinky finger while hauling 2x4s and gyprock from his truck to his neighbor's front room. Kids rode by on bikes and punks rode by on skateboards. Couples wandered through the park across the street, their murmurous conversations clear on the whispering breeze that rattled the leaves. He hadn't gotten any writing done, and that was all right. He had plenty of time, and once the sound wall was in, he'd be able to get a good night's sleep and really focus down on the story. A Chinese girl and a white boy walked down the sidewalk, talking intensely. They were all of 6, and the boy had a Russian accent. The market's diversity always excited Alan. The boy looked a little bit like Alan's brother Doug, Dan, David, Dearborn, had looked when he was that age. Doug was the one he'd helped murder. All the brothers helped with the murder, even Charlie, Clem, Carlos, Corey, the island, who'd opened a great fissure down his main fault line and closed it up over Doug's corpse, ensuring that their parents would be none the wiser. Doug was a stubborn son of a bitch, though, and his corpse had tunneled up over the next 6 years, built a raft from the bamboo and vines that grew in proliferation on Carlos's west coast. He sailed the raft through treacherous seas for a year and a day, beached it on their father's gentle slope, and presented himself to their mother. By that time, the corpse had decayed and frayed and worn away, so that he was little more than a torso and stumps, his tongue withered and stiff. But he pled his case to their mother, and she was so upset that her load overbalanced and they had to restart her. Their father was so angry that he quaked and caved in Billy, Bob, Brad, Benny's room, crushing all his tools and all his trophies. But a lot of time had gone by, and the brothers weren't kids anymore. Alan was only 19, ready to move to Toronto and start scouting for real estate. Only Doug still looked like a little boy, albeit a stumpy and desiccated one. He hollered and stamped until his finger bones rattled on the floor and his tongue flew across the room and cracked on the wall. When his anger was spent, he crawled atop their mother and let her rock him into a long, long slumber. Alan had left his father and his family the next morning, carrying a rucksack heavy with gold from under the mountain, and walked down to the town, taking the same trail he'd walked every school day since he was five. He waved to the people that drove past him on the highway as he waited at the bus stop. He was the first son to leave home under his own power, and he'd been full of butterflies, but he had a half dozen good books that he checked out of the Kappa's Casing Branch Library to keep him occupied on the 14-hour journey. And before he knew it, the bus was pulling off the Gardiner Expressway by the Sky Dome and into the midnight streets of Toronto, where the blinking lights of the Yonge Street sleaze strip receded into the distance, like a landing strip for a horny UFO. His liquid cash was tight, so he spent the night in the Rex Hotel, in the worst room in the house, right over the cymbal tree that the jazz drummer below hammered on until nearly 2 a.m. The bed was small and hard and smelled of bleach and must. The wash basin gurgled mysteriously and spat out moist sewage odors, and he'd read all his books. So he sat in the window and watched the drunks and the hipsters stagger down Queen Street and inhaled the smoky air, and before he knew it, he'd nodded off in the chair with his heavy coat around him like a blanket. The Chinese girl abruptly thumped her fist into the Russian boy's ear. He clutched his head and howled, tears streaming down his face while the Chinese girl ran off. Alan shook his head, got up off his chair, went inside for a cold washcloth and an ice pack, and came back out. The Russian boy's face was screwed up and blotchy and streaked with tears, and it made him look even more like Doug, who'd always been a crybaby. Alan couldn't understand him, but he took a guess and knelt at his side and wiped the boy's face, then put the ice pack in his little hand and pressed it to the side of his little head. "Come on," he said, taking the boy's other hand. "Where do your parents live? I'll get you home." Alan met Krishna the next morning at 10 a.m. as Alan was running a table saw on the neighbor's front lawn, sawing studs up to fit the second wall. Krishna came out of the house in a dirty dressing gown, his short hair matted with gel from the night before. He was tall and fit and muscular, his brown calves flashing through the vent of his housecoat. He was smoking a hand-rolled cigarette and clutching a can of Coke. Alan shut down the saw and shifted his goggles up to his forehead. "Good morning," he said. "I'd stay on the porch if I were you, or maybe put on some shoes. There's lots of nails and splinters around." Krishna, about to step off the porch, stepped back. "You must be Alvin," he said. "Yep," Alan said, going up the stairs, sticking out his hand. "And you must be Krishna. You're pretty good with a guitar, you know that?" Krishna shook briefly, then snatched his hand back and rubbed at his stubble. "I know. You're pretty fucking loud with a table saw." Alan looked sheepish. "Sorry about that. I wanted to get the heavy work done before it got too hot. Hope I'm not disturbing you too much. Today's the only sawing day. I'll be hammering for the next day or two, and then it's all wet work. The loudest tool I'll be using is sandpaper. Won't take more than 4 days tops anyway, and we'll be in good shape." Krishna gave him a long, considering look. "What are you anyway?" "I'm a writer, for now. Used to have a few shops." Krishna blew a plume of smoke off into the distance. "That's not what I mean. What are you, Adam? Alan? Andrew? I've met people like you before. There's something not right about you." Alan didn't know what to say to that. This was bound to come up someday. "Where are you from?" "Up north, near Kappa's Casing," he said. "A little town." "I don't believe you," Krishna said. "Are you an alien? A fairy? What?" Alan shook his head. "Just about what I seem, I'm afraid. Just a guy." "Just about?" he said. "Just about. There's a lot of wiggle room in just about, Arthur. It's a free country, but just the same, I don't think I like you very much. Far as I'm concerned, you could get lost and never come back." "Sorry you feel that way, Krishna. I hope I'll grow in you as time goes by." "I hope that you won't have the chance to," Krishna said, flicking the dog end of his cigarette toward the sidewalk. Alan didn't like or understand Krishna, but that was okay. He understood the others just fine, more or less. Natalie had taken to helping him out after her classes, mudding and taping the drywall, then sanding it down, priming and painting it. Her brother Link came home from work sweaty and grimy with road dust, but he always grabbed a beer for Natalie and Alan after a shower, and they'd sit on the porch and kibitz. Mimi was less hospitable. She sulked in her room while Alan worked on the sound wall, coming downstairs only to fetch her breakfast and coldly ignoring him then, despite his cheerful greetings. Alan had to force himself not to stare after her as she walked into the kitchen, carrying yesterday's dishes down from her room, then out again, with a sandwich and a fresh plate. Her curly hair bounced as she stomped back and forth, her soft round buttocks flexing under her long johns. On the night that Alan and Natalie put the first coat of paint on the wall, Mimi came down in a little baby doll dress, thigh-high striped tights, and chunky shoes, her face painted with swaths of glitter. "You look wonderful, baby," Natalie told her as she emerged onto the porch. "Going out?" "Going to the club," she said. "DJ None of Your Fucking Business is spinning and Krishna's going to get me in for free."
"Dance music," Link said disgustedly. Then, to Alan, "You nosy stuff? It's not playing music, it's playing records. Snore."
"Sounds interesting," Alan said. "Do you have any of it that I could listen to? A CD or some MP3s?
"Oh, that's not how you listen to this stuff," Natalie said. "You have to go to a club and dance."
"Really?" Alan said. "Do I have to take ecstasy, or is that optional?"
"It's mandatory," Mimi said, the first word she'd spoken to him all week. "Great fistfuls of E, and then you have to consume 2 pounds of candy necklaces at an after-hours orgy."
"Not really," Natalie said, sotto voce, "but you do have to dance. You should go with Mimi to the club. DJ None of Your Fucking Business is amazing."
"I don't think Mimi wants company," Alan said.
"What makes you say that?" Mimi said, making a dare of it with hip-shot body language.
"Get changed and we'll go together. You'll have to pay to get in, though." Link and Natalie exchanged a raised eyebrow, but Alan was already headed for his place, fumbling for his keys. He bounded up the stairs, swiped a washcloth over his face, threw on a pair of old cargo pants and a faded steel pole bathtub t-shirt he'd bought from a head shop one day, because he liked the words Incongruity, though he'd never heard the band, added a faded jean jacket and a pair of high-tech sneakers, grabbed his phone, and bounded back down the stairs. He was convinced that Mimi would be long gone by the time he got back out front, but she was still there, the stripes in her stockings glowing in the slanting light.
"Retro chic," she said, and laughed nastily. Natalie gave him a thumbs up and a smile that Alan uncharitably took for a simper and felt guilty about immediately afterward. He returned the thumbs up and then took off after Mimi, who'd already started down Augusta, headed for Queen Street.
"What's the cover charge?" he said once they'd caught up.
$20, she said. "It's an all-ages show, so they won't be selling a lot of booze, so there's a high cover."
"How's the play coming?"
"Fuck off about the play, okay?" she said, and spat on the sidewalk.
"All right, then," he said. "I'm going to start writing my story tomorrow," he said.
"Your story, huh?"
"Yup.
What's that for?"
"What do you mean?" he asked playfully.
"Why are you writing a story?"
"Well, I have to. I've completely redone the house, built that sound wall. It'd be a shame not to write the story now."
"You're writing a story about your house?"
"No, in my house. I haven't decided what the story's about yet. That'll be job one tomorrow."
"You did all that work to have a place to write? Man, I thought I was into procrastination."
He chuckled self-deprecatingly. "I guess you could look at it that way. I just wanted to have a nice creative environment to work in. The story's important to me is all."
"What are you going to do with it once you're done? There aren't a whole lot of places that publish short stories these days, you know."
"Oh, I know it. I'd write a novel if I had the patience, but this isn't for publication, yet. It's going into a drawer to be published after I die."
"What?
Like Emily Dickinson. Wrote thousands of poems, stuck them in a drawer, dropped dead. Someone else published them and she made it into the canon. I'm going to do the same."
"That's nuts. Are you dying?"
"No, but I don't want to put this off until I am. Could get hit by a bus, you know."
"You're a goddamn psycho. Krishna was right."
"What does Krishna have against me?"
"I think we both know what that's about," she said.
"No, really, what did I ever do to him?" Now they were on Queen Street, walking east in the early evening crowd, surrounded by summertime hipsters and wafting, appetizing smells from the bistros and Jamaican roti shops. She stopped abruptly and grabbed his shoulders and gave him a hard shake.
"You're full of shit, Adman. I know it and you know it." I really don't know what you're talking about, honestly.
Fine, let's do this.
She clamped her hand on his forearm and dragged him down a side street and turned down an alley. She stepped into a doorway and started unbuttoning her Alice Blue baby doll dress. Alan looked away, embarrassed, glad of the dark hiding his blush. Once her dress was unbuttoned to her waist, she reached around behind her and unhooked her white underwire bra, which sagged forward under the weight of her heavy breasts. She turned around, treating him to a glimpse of the full curve of her breast under her arm, and shrugged the dress down around her waist. She had two stubby, leathery wings growing out of the middle of her back, just above the shoulder blades. They sat flush against her back, and as Alan watched, they unfolded and flexed, flapped a few times, and settled back into their position, nestled among the soft roll of flesh that descended from her neck. Involuntarily, he peered forward, examining the wings, which were covered in fine, downy brown hairs, and their bases, roped with muscle and surrounded by a mess of ugly scars.
"You sewed these on?" Alan said, aghast.
She turned around, her eyes bright with tears, her breasts swung free of her unhooked bra.
"No, you fucking idiot! I sawed them off. 4 times a year, they just grow back. If I don't cut them, they grow down to my ankles."
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.